was going to call you Dad.
It's quite an introduction there, one and only. In some ways, it's not actually true. I'm like the fourth. My first name is actually William, and I'm like the fourth William Hanawalt in my family. And my son is also William Hanawalt, so unique only in some ways, I guess. I'm going to go ahead and pray again. I just find that to be, before I even give a talk, let alone get in a place to receive something somebody else has to say, prayer just really helps me do that. So please join with me again. Jesus, I pray you'd bless any and everything I have to say. As I share today in an effort to help us connect with you and each other, help us navigate life, help us find what you could be offering us each day. I pray that any words that I have or thoughts that I share in service to that would resonate. And as me being a flawed human, anything I say that somehow hits us poorly, whether it's because me as a speaker is imperfect or because each of us have our own woundings and our own stories and the own realities, or anytime somebody's sharing something, there can be things that hit us in a way that's not most welcomed. I pray that you would be graceful in that. And you really bless the time we have here together. And that our own agendas for it would feel secondary to what the offer is from you. Amen. So we're in the middle of a series right now that's been looking at things that have changed my life. So as Vince and I have shared, and Nader will be sharing in a couple weeks, Nader Sihuni, we're looking at practices, ways of thinking. Vince last week shared like this church, how they have changed our lives for the better. And today, I want to look at something that's shaped me quite a bit. It's what I've come to find to be the answer of somewhat of the ever-present question of, like, what is the wise thing to do? Like, how do I navigate this life that I have? And I have found that the realization that I'm going to share with you today helps me navigate the ever-changing, unpredictable, and often disappointing world I live in. It helps me pursue what's wise. So I grew up in Evanston, not too far away from here, and I grew up with kind of the basic American educational narrative. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but I'm going to guess you are. It's the idea that you need to do well in elementary school because that's going to prepare you for middle school, and you need to do well in middle school because that's going to set you up to get into the right classes and the right habits for high school, where you need to do well in high school so you can graduate with good scores to be able to get into a good college. And you need to do that because you want to set yourself up for a good job, and the good job is where the happiness and good life comes in. So if you fail that fourth grade spelling test, that's a big deal because you have now set that trajectory off track. So I have tended in my life to be an all or nothing kind of person, for those that know me well. And when I was in seventh grade, I started to question this system a little bit. I'm sure that's not too foreign for people questioning this system. And I started to look around at the people in my life or people in the media who I saw as successful or happy. And it began to seem to me that that narrative was not the consistent reality. And the truth was, is I had a few people really close to me in my life at that time who didn't follow that educational path but seemed to really enjoy their life. And I had a few people close to me in my life at that time who did follow that educational path that seemed rather unhappy with their life. So in my seventh grade self, who was even more of an all and nothing kind of person, I came to the most logical conclusion one can. And I decided I wasn't going to do anything I didn't want to do. I was just only going to do the things that I wanted. If I am not guaranteed happiness and health by following this along, so why put in the work? And so my seventh grade year, much to the great embarrassment of my parents, I chose to not do a single homework assignment the entire year. You may ask, so I did papers and projects and tests, but I just did not turn in a single daily homework assignment. And in seventh grade, that's a lot. You get a lot of homework in seventh grade on the daily homework ready. And I just didn't do a single one, which in hindsight, it was like 9 times as much work to hide it from my parents as it would have been just to do the homework. So we fast forward, and I talk about this recently with my mother, and the like extreme shame still comes across her face of like, how did that happen? And is also a big indicator to me today where I think about how people's lives have turned out, and I have a hard time believing that just hard work is the thing that goes well and not goes well, because I didn't do hard work and I'm pretty happy with where life turned out. And I think it has a lot to do with the people and structures and systems that were there to support me. So I thought in my mind, if this is a lie, I'm just not going to do it. I'm going to opt out of this system. And, of course, my parents eventually did find out. You can't hide that forever. Report cards do come home. Principals do say, I'm not sure he's going to go on to eighth grade, things like that. But they did. They passed me along, and they said I could do it, and with lots of structures and accountability. And so it wasn't actually that I decided I wanted to do it. I just had so many things in place that it was just way too much work to get around not doing it. And that's kind of where I stayed. I didn't actually change my mindset about these things. I did just enough to get by academically. And that was until 11th grade. And I had a teacher. I don't know if you've ever had teachers like this, but Miss Rahana. She was my 11th grade English teacher. This is the creepiness of Facebook, by the way. I haven't seen her in like 2 decades. And yet she's displayed here for you. I don't know. So the first week of class, I show up to class, and unsurprisingly, she comes to the conclusion that I have not been putting full effort into my work. So the reality is I've had this conversation about 35 times up to 11th grade, where a teacher said to me, Kyle, if you just applied yourself, this could go really well for you. Kyle, if you just tried, if you put in a little bit of effort, this could go really well for you. And the first 35 times, that did not stick. And so I needed 36 chances to hear this message. But for some reason, the way she said it really stuck to me. And she said to me, and as I kind of gave my 11th grade spiel back to her of like, why does it even matter? Look at this person and look at this person. I don't care. I don't even want to do those things. She looked at me and she's like, oh, you're right. Doing your best is not going to guarantee you anything. That you doing well in school and getting into a good college so that you get a good job isn't going to guarantee you're happy. But you know what, Kyle? It still matters. Even if nothing is guaranteed through this effort, it is still worthwhile to you. You will actually benefit by learning more. You will actually benefit. You will be better off for it personally by trying. But even more than that, even if you don't want to do any of those things that you say you want to do, it will open up doors for you that will not be open if you don't try. And there was something about the way she said it. It didn't feel condemning. It didn't feel like, but it just hit me. And it was the first time that something switched for me that thought, what if I tried not because I'm trying to not be in trouble, but what if I tried because it may actually be worthwhile for me? And I did. And my whole life has gone on a different trajectory. I've been a great student ever since then. My other job is I work in elementary schools, actually in the same district that I grew up in. And I see some of those teachers now, and they're like, wow, you made it. That's surprising. So something clicked that even though nothing was guaranteed, it still mattered. That things don't always work out, but the choices we make matter. And so this was an early lesson for me in life. Something that I would actually learn to be kind of a day-to-day part of my adult life. And that is that we, like I said, I've always been kind of an all-or-out person. So these have been the two threats that I have experienced, and I wonder if you experience these same things too. Two things vying for us to fall into the pit and agree with them. The first being cynicism. That was my experience. It's life isn't fair, none of this matters, so why try? Like, I've been excellent at emotional detachment. I've been excellent at seeing, well, maybe this doesn't matter, so I'm gonna pull back and be cynical about the world, observe it from the outside. Why even do homework? The second one being perfectionism. That life does come down to me and my effort. Life comes down to what I can pull off and what I can make happen. And then there's a sense of when I've been living out of this place of perfection, there's like this grim drivenness that I have to get everything right, that I better ace that fourth grade spelling test because who knows what the future will await if I don't. You know, it's this wisdom, this kind of Misrahana wisdom that I think saves us when we feel overwhelmed by either of these threats. It saves us by cutting through the BS claims of both of them. It shows us something much less cynical and something much more hopeful. Not cheap hope, but something mature, something that's kind of deeply feeling true that helps us manage to both be optimistic but also grounded. You know, and this kind of wisdom, this Misrahana wisdom, is what I want to talk about today. Now, many of us years later, I've learned that though it may seem unexpected to some, I don't know, that the Bible is actually the greatest source of this kind of mature, real, hopeful wisdom. And there's two books in particular today that I want to look at that I have found really helpful in figuring out adult life. Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. So they're called what's called wisdom literature. It's kind of a common thing in the ancient world, wisdom literature. It's kind of like maybe blogs or op-ed pieces would be common today. They're just concerned with how do we best do life. They are answering the questions of how do you get the most out of life? How do you deal with the innate challenges? They help people process reality. And there was two kind of primary forms of wisdom literature, one that's represented in Proverbs well and one that's represented in Ecclesiastes well. The first one is proverbial wisdom. Surprising, where do you think this got the name? Proverbs, proverbial wisdom. These are short, succinct sayings on life. Proverbs has, it's like every single line is a new saying. It's just short and quick to the point. The second is kind of contemplative or speculative wisdom. They're monologues or dialogues that kind of dive into deep existential issues. What is the meaning of life? The problems of suffering. And the nature of both of these, the nature of wisdom literature, is to speak on absolute terms about things that are generally true. So they often can feel overstated because they are speaking of a general truth in absolute terms. And this is why I think it's important to note that the wisdom books should be read in light of each other. I think this is what it's called, reading the Bible in concert with itself. Which, by the way, just in general, is one of the most helpful things we can do when reading the Bible. To read the Bible as a whole and see how the many parts inform and speak to each other. Because I don't know about you, but I at least have experienced it's way too easy to read one passage or one part and misinterpret it because I'm taking it out of context. But in this case, they work so well together because Proverbs and Ecclesiastes create a counterbalance to each other. You know, when you take each one of these alone, to me at least, it brought up some hard and troubling questions. But when I read them together, it actually painted a full and nuanced picture of life. And that's why I think it's so important to see them as two parts of a whole. So on one side, we have Proverbs. It's written by the Israelite king, the son of King David, Solomon. Most of the Proverbs are written by Solomon. And he's known for being the wisest of men. And as you notice, we'll read some in a moment, he speaks what is generally true in life. But he phrases them in absolute terms. It can almost read like a science formula. If you do good, then this good thing will happen. If you do bad, then this bad thing will happen. But when we read this alone, I think it can feel misleading because, at least for me, my experience of life is not that simple. I see good people do good things and have bad results. And I see people that seem to be doing terrible things and seem to be rewarded. However, I think there are wise and helpful words in the wisdom of Proverbs. And so with that in mind, I'm going to read Proverbs. You're going to have some of this in your program. There's quite a bit here, so you may not have all of it in there. But pay attention to what's written. I think it's very helpful. If it's a little overstated, okay, but it's the general truths it's communicating. So Proverbs 1, starting in verse 1. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, For gaining wisdom and instruction, for understanding words of insight, for receiving instruction in prudent behavior. This is what we're doing here. Doing what is right and just and fair. For giving prudence to those who are simple, knowledge and discretion to the young. Let the wise listen and add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance. For understanding proverbs and parables, the saying of the wise, the sayings and riddles of the wise. And then a little snapshot of the flavor of them in chapter 10, starting in verse 1. A wise son brings joy to his father. A foolish son brings grief to his mother. Ill-gotten treasures have no lasting value, but righteousness delivers from evil. The Lord does not let righteous go hungry, and he thwarts the craving of the wicked. Lazy hands make for poverty, but diligence hands bring wealth. I see a little bit of my own narrative growing up in that last one. And then we want to look at Proverbs' counterbalance, the counterbalance to Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. So Ecclesiastes can take the other extreme. Whereas Proverbs says, do this so life goes well, Ecclesiastes essentially says, none of it matters. It is all meaningless. Good people are hurt, bad people prosper. It can paint a picture that nothing in life matters at all. Again, that resonated with me at one age. However, it also it paints like a profound picture of in the midst of a life that's unfair, what we can do. What is the good we can find? And actually, almost to highlight, you should read this in hand with Proverbs. It actually begins pretending it is Solomon speaking. And then by the time you get to verse 12 in the first chapter, it's clear that it's actually just a literary ploy. It's actually somebody who calls himself the teacher or Kohelet. But it pretends it's Solomon, almost to say, keep Proverbs in mind when you read this. And so reading from Ecclesiastes, verse 1:1. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem, again saying, hey, I'm Solomon, even though it's not. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? All right, so there's a little bit of a depressing tone to Ecclesiastes. If Proverbs is like, follow this path so life goes well, if Ecclesiastes is kind of the exact opposite. So in chapter 2, starting in verse 17, kind of being a picture of what's said here. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing of the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must have left them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish. Yet they have control over the fruit of my toil, into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. Now this is too meaningless. So my heart began to despair over my toilsome labor under the sun. For a person may labor with wisdom and knowledge and skill, and then they must leave all that they own to another who has not toiled for it. I don't know if that resonates with anybody's experience of work. This is too meaningless. It is a great misfortune. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving which with they labor under the sun? All their days, their work is grief and pain. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This is too meaningless. I wonder if that does resonate with anybody a little bit, on a bad day maybe. But in the midst of the painful toil that we see filled life, Ecclesiastes does have some really powerful wisdom, which is when life feels terrible and meaningless, there's still something we can find. In chapter 5, starting in verse 18, this, it's almost like everything else I've said for 5 chapters is terrible, and now this is what I've observed to be good. And it's like 3 verses. That it's appropriate for a person to eat, to drink, and to find satisfaction in their toilsome labor under the sun during the few good days God has given them. For this is their lot. Moreover, when God gives someone wealth and possessions and the ability to enjoy them, to accept their lot and to be happy for their toil, this is a gift from God. They seldom reflect on the days of their life because God keeps them occupied with the gladness of heart. So, you see, if we read 1, without the other, we get a pretty misleading picture of reality. However, when we read them together, we get a clear and true picture of reality that values wise choices, which do matter, but also recognizes that even the best laid plans don't always work out. This is the wisdom of our title today. This always works, except when it doesn't. You know, I think about, I just wore my Brian Piccolo jersey today for the Bears, but I felt like he's a perfect example of this Proverbs and Ecclesiastes wisdom. He was like an undersized running back who wasn't considered to be like a very talented prospect, worked his butt off to become a player in the NFL, only to get diagnosed with cancer and die before he could finish his career. It is both the wisdom of working hard and the meaninglessness of an unfair life. I don't know, it's just I thought about it. And I think it's the wisdom of these two things. It always works, except when it doesn't. It's a kind of deeply true feeling wisdom that saves us from both the detachment of cynicism and the weight and grim drivenness of perfectionism. And so I think the wisdom of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes in specific, I think it highlights three things that we can take away from this. One is it encourages us to make choices to better our lives for the future. So we see the book of Proverbs is a clear value on wise, healthy living, that making wise choices for our future can prepare us to live a fuller and more meaningful life. The choices we make today matter. There's not always an immediate return on them, but in the long term, following the wisdom of Proverbs will lead to a better life in general. That is the power of Proverbs. That it's not always about the short-term pleasures. It's not always about what feels easiest now. But it's about making the wise and healthy choices so we can set up a life that feels deep and meaningful. Like, I would never have ended up where I am today. Finished college, grad school. I would have never done those things if I didn't start making wiser choices after my 36th chance. In the end, the choices we make today matter. I think if I was going to summarize the book of Proverbs, it would be wise choices today have a big payoff for the future. Foolish choices today have consequences for our future. But when we read Proverbs and Ecclesiastes today, we also see even our best efforts are not always good enough. The book of Ecclesiastes shows us that even when we try our best, even when we follow the blueprint, do everything right, sometimes it can feel like our efforts are meaningless. That the reality that we're not able to control the outcome of our life, that failure and disappointment are not always in our hands, that at times our hard work leads to the success of others and not us. That at times when we do work out and things have come together and we did the things and things panned out and it all happened, we realize we overvalued that return on our happiness. We told ourselves, once I got that job, I'd be happy. Once I finished school, I'd be happy. Once I got that vacation or that relationship, I'd be happy. And Proverbs says that stuff matters. It does. But we are likely not as accurate at predicting the impact it actually has on our life. Thus, at times, finding the good life is not always about our ability to make it. And in the world we live in today, many of us, the choices and the outcomes we have aren't even in our own hands. That because of things, the ceilings and the limitations that social inequity creates, I think the balance of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes can say, even though we try, sometimes it doesn't work out. But when we read these things together, we see that although we should make good choices and things don't always work out, we always have the invitation to appreciate today. I mean, I really love the wisdom that Ecclesiastes brings out. I don't know about you. I love sad music sometimes. Like, I loved Elliott Smith for a while. And I feel the same way when I read Ecclesiastes sometimes. It just, like, agrees with my sadness sometimes. But then the little beats of, like, but just feel so helpful when I'm in that place. that enjoying the moment and not letting the future run unchecked in our hearts. For when we're worrying about the future and we're grieving the past, we can miss out on what the present has to offer us. For we actually can do a lot to impact our present reality. To use the words of Ecclesiastes, we can appreciate the food, appreciate the drink, and we can even appreciate the toil of the day as a gift from God. There's a sense of satisfaction from doing it. And we'll find more joy when we can find contentment with what we do have today than always thinking about what we don't have but want in the future. For when we get what we want, if that is our basis of happiness, I get what I want, that's what makes me happy, I think we will find that very rarely does that pan out, either because it doesn't pan out at all, or when it does pan out, it doesn't quite have the impact on our happiness we thought. That we can find joy and value in the moment, no matter how meaningless it appears. That we can find joy in a mundane job, in a challenging relationship. Even the simpleness of a donut on a Sunday morning can be worth appreciating. We can ask God to help us enjoy our current life. And he can offer joy in this very day. And the kind of joy we tend to only reserve for when things work out. So I think this is the wisdom of these things. Your choices matter. Sometimes it doesn't matter. But we can find joy and contentment today. And so in an effort to kind of grab a hold of this, how do we actually live out this wisdom? How do we actually get this? I have a tip for us today. Begin each day by asking Jesus to help you see the unique gift it offers. And then end each day by thanking Jesus for whatever gifts you found. This has been the kind of the clearest way I've done it. So in Proverbs fashion, we're starting off the day and say, Jesus, help me see what I need to see today. I've usually prayed something along the lines of, Jesus, what do you have for me today? We're preparing ourselves to receive guidance and wisdom, to see the things he might want to highlight for the day. I think this is the wise words of Proverbs. And then we end each day in true Ecclesiastes fashion, which is regardless of the day, success or toil, we thank Jesus for whatever gift it offered. It may be a simple thing, once from the wisdom of Ecclesiastes, thank you for the dinner I ate, the food and the drink I enjoyed. That even if things didn't work out as I had hoped, there are still things worth being thankful for. And what's even more is this isn't just the proverbial wisdom of Proverbs and the abstract wisdom of Ecclesiastes. In this act, we're engaging in relationship. It's not just thanking in general, it's thanking Jesus. It's not just asking life in general what day has for you, but asking Jesus. And what I have found in this interactive relationship, my heart begins to soften. The cynicism that I feel prone to breaks down. That drivenness of perfectionism holds less weight. And I find my value and my sense of being solid not built on detaching myself so it doesn't matter, and not built on my ability to do it, but built on Jesus's affirmation of me. I think this equips us to both pursue the wise way forward readily and also find joy and contentment when life doesn't work out. In a moment here, we're going to enter into a time of prayer and singing, something that communities like ours have done for centuries. I think it engages us in a different kind of way. And we invite you to participate in whatever way feels best to you, to sing along. Feel free to sit and let the music hit you if you feel more in a reflective state. And as that's going on, we're going to have a team of people in that middle section that will be available to pray with you. And I would invite you to take us up on that offer. These are not weird people. They're not going to give you unasked for advice. They're just going to be there to pray with you. And I invite you, if you resonate with any part of this, so if you resonate with cynicism, life just feels kind of meaningless, and I just want to detach myself, if you resonate with perfectionism, life, the way I feel okay about life is by getting everything right. I have found in interaction with Jesus, he wants to free us from that. He wants to lead us into a life where we can find joy and contentment in our daily reality and pursue a wise way forward. So as we're singing up here, please feel free to go to that middle section and ask somebody to come alongside and pray with you. Or if you have any other circumstantial, physical, or emotional need, they'd be happy to pray with you. You'll know who the team is because they'll have badges that say prayer team. If everyone would stand with me, I'd like to pray. Jesus, thank you so much that you do not leave us to do life alone. And thank you so much that you agree with reality and you are the greatest partner to navigating reality. That in pursuing you, we don't have to deny that the world is unfair. And in pursuing you, we don't overlook the weight of wise choices. But in either step, we're invited to do so in relationship with you. That we're not abstractly invited to consider what is wise, and not abstractly invited to consider where we might find joy and contentment in the midst of toil. You invite us actively today with us. And so, Jesus, I ask that anybody here that's resonating with the struggle of cynicism or the struggle of perfectionism, in your name, I ask that you would break it. You are not okay because of your ability to get things perfect. And it is not easier to be cynical. And Jesus, I ask for help to be engaged, help to be present, help to pursue things that are good, and find true comfort and partnership when things don't work out. Pray in your name. Amen.